special guest today. His name is Major Garrett. He's a longtime or a former longtime Fox News reporter and Fox senior White House correspondent. Followed the 2004 and 2008 presidential elections. Has recently become the congressional correspondent for the National Journal. Author of numerous books. Major, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
Tell me, why'd you make the change from Fox to the National Journal?
Well, before I got into television 10 years ago, and CNN was my first employer way back then, I was a print journalist 17 years. Worked in the low minor leagues of American newspaper journalism, Amarillo, Las Vegas, Houston, and Washington. And print's always what I've enjoyed most. And I have about a third of my career left. And I knew if I'd continued re-signing at Fox and doing the TV thing, that would be the rest of my career. And I really wanted to get back to the thing that I enjoy most about this business and the part of the business that's in the greatest transition, the print side of it. In the digital world and National Journal provided me not only a great platform, but gave me a chance to be part of a company that was remaking itself and making a lot of decisions about content and the displaying of that content, the pricing of that content that are, I think, are central to the whole future of print in American journalism. And I just really wanted to ride that for a while. So that's what I did, and here's where I am.
That's great.
All right. Well, just while you were at Fox and as senior White House correspondent, what's it like being in the White House on a daily basis?
Well, it's one of the greatest jobs you could ever have in my world, in the journalism world. And it's a job that requires you to be prepared at any minute for anything.
I imagine.
And I remember oftentimes, if there would be a surprise presidential news conference, Bush or Obama or even Clinton, when I first got started, some White House reporters would get angry, like, well, we need more time, we need more preparation, we need more warning. And I felt like, look, you cover the President of the United States, at any moment, at any hour of any day, you need to have five questions that you're prepared to put to the President on a moment's notice. You always need to be ready to ask the President five really big things. And so I never was stumped by a short announced sort of fire drill press conference, and didn't always get called on. But when I did my level best. Had a what I would describe as a professional relationship with every White House I covered. Every president that I covered, Clinton, Bush, and Obama, didn't like the questions I asked. Thought they were too tough at times, but dealt with me fairly, and it was a great platform, a great place to be.
Tell us your favorite moment from covering the White House and maybe favorite press conference and the favorite question you asked and the response and how that all went.
Well, I would say probably the question that I've asked a president that's most remembered, if any are remembered, and I'm not arrogant enough to assume any particularly are, but when the Iranian Revolution was going on, and people were protesting in the street, and the government was cracking down, and the Obama White House was pretty slow, I think, by everyone's estimation, Republican, Democrat, foreign policy experts, in identifying itself and identifying the American voice with those protesters in the street. The president had a press conference and said some very tough things in support, in condemning the Iranian regime and supporting the protesters, things he hadn't said for at least two or three or 4 weeks. And they were of a tone and tenor completely opposite of where he had been. And unusually, the president in that press conference didn't call on the Associated Press or one of the wire services. He called on me first, which put me a bit on the spot because I wasn't exactly ready to be the first questioner. So I repeated what the president said that was stronger than he ever said before, and I just looked up to him and said, "What took you so long?"
Oh, wow.
What was he did not like that question at all. But it cut to the heart of the issue. His handling of the issue and what he was trying to communicate to the world and why he was suddenly, or if not suddenly, late to the game communicating those issues. And I know he didn't like it because the next time I interviewed the president, we were in Moscow on a trip there, and the networks were given 10 minutes, and I was in the rotation, and we sat down, and the president looked at me, and he said, not with a great deal of anger, but with a directness, if you will.
Right.
So what was that whole question about? What did you spend a week, a month working on that one? What was that all about?
Oh, wow.
I just said, well, Mr. President, it was a question, a fair question, and let's move on. You know, so not a moment that redefined American journalism, but one I'm proud of.
Wow. And certainly you should be. And what a great question. Now, you're author of a number of books. Have any of those been recent?
not really recent. The last book I wrote, and this is another reason why I sort of left the vortex of cable news, because I do intend and have every hope of writing more books, not just one more book, but several more books. And, of course, I need time and a publisher to do that. I'm working on the time equation now. I'll seek out a publisher when I have a really good idea. But the last book I wrote came out in 2005, and it was a 10-year look back at the Contract with America election, 1994, the first Republican Congress in the House in 40 years, and how that changed the Clinton White House, how it changed American politics, and how it changed the trajectory of a lot of policy in this country. And by that time, when I started working on that book, about 7 books had been written from the Clinton White House's perspective on how they just throttled and beat back and defeated Republicans in Congress left right. and right. And having covered it, I knew, I mean, that's certainly an argument that a partisan would make, but I didn't think it fit with the facts as I knew them and as the history would reflect. So I thought, why don't I take an approach to this question from the idea of those in Congress who, in many significant ways, redirected the course of the Clinton White House. And quite happily, the book has been very well received in academic and journalistic circles. It didn't sell very well, but when the Washington Post asked its readers about a year ago to name the top nonfiction books ever in politics, my book, The Enduring Revolution, made the list. So that's not bad.
The title is The Enduring Revolution?
Yes.
If folks wanted to buy that, where would they go to buy it?
You can buy it on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. As my kids like to tell me, it costs less than 75 cents.
All right. Now, obviously, with the experience you have being inside the White House and the inner workings of politics inside the Beltway, what's your assessment of this debt ceiling and the negotiations that surround it?
Well, for the first thing I think people need to understand is we've never had this argument about this question before. The debt ceiling historically has been a burden of governance, and the president had to ask, and whoever was in power in Congress had to move it along. It was considered an obligation of government and never used as a moment to sort of ask deeper questions about the trajectory of debt, the policies that are driving debt and deficits in this country. And this last election in 2010, a lot of these new 87 members of the freshman class on the Republican side said, look, we're not doing that anymore. This moment, previously just an obligation of governance, is not going to be that anymore. We are treating it differently. And we're going to talk about all these underlying issues and not just raise the debt ceiling, like every other Congress has done. And so this is a new debate, or it's not a new debate. The questions of budget, taxation, priorities, that's not new. What is new is the context. And I think the public looks at the debt ceiling and says, well, I don't want to raise the debt ceiling. I don't want more debt. I don't want more spending. Even though historically we've always done it because you have to make good on the obligations already agreed to by the U.S. government. It's not assigning new spending. It's just paying for the spending we've already agreed to. And yet it's now a moment. And the moment is, what are we going to do? Are we going to change the way we finance our government structurally, or are we just going to I'm so tired of this metaphor, kick the can down the road, but it's become such a commonly used one, I'll fall back on it, and raise the debt ceiling but not change the way America governs itself from a fiscal perspective. And that's really the heart and center of this debate.
Do you have any predictions as to the outcome?
Yes. Three. We will not have a comprehensive bill passed by the August 2nd deadline. We will have a short-term debt extension while negotiations in the process continues. That's prediction one. So we will not default, but this August 2nd deadline where everything has to be done by, not everything is going to be done by then. So we're going to move it through. But the debt ceiling will be raised enough to give Treasury the flexibility it needs to meet obligations. Keep an eye on the proposal from Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid, the two Republican and Democratic leaders of the Senate, because they know where the votes are in the Senate. And they'll put together a plan that will cut anywhere from $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion in spending. There'll be no tax increases. There may be things that have revenue implications, selling off some federal land, auctioning off some broadband spectrum that the federal government currently holds, maybe increasing some user fees, but it'll be predominantly spending cuts. And then the question will be for the House of Representatives, can that pass? Is that big enough to pass? The initial reaction of the House will be no, but the prospect of risking default, I think, will concentrate the mind, and over time, sometime in the first or second week of August, it'll be that plan that's most likely to get across the finish line.
The Mitch McConnell plan, the Harry Reid plan, does that seem as anemic to you as it does to me?
Well, it's very crafty as a matter of politics. From a Republican's perspective, and not that I view this from that perspective, but right. I know why Mitch McConnell drafted it this way. It's extremely crafty in a matter of politics. I think Mitch McConnell's fundamental misunderstanding, though, is that many Republicans who elected this 2010 wave Congress are no longer interested in tactical political answers. They want structural changes of significant degree. And why it's crafty on the political side is, first of all, it tells the president, you have to ask. And when you ask, you have to accompany that ask with specified, written down spending cuts. So from a political perspective, it puts the onus or the burden on the president, and it ties, for the remainder of this presidency, any increase in the debt limit to specified spending cuts written down by the president. Of course, Republicans have been saying for months now they can't get the president to commit to any particular plan. Well, this would force him to commit to a plan and do something that almost no president would want to do, which is tie any increase in the debt ceiling to spending cuts. That would be, from a political perspective, on the Republican side, a big win, because that's never been the case before. We've always just raised the debt ceiling, and it's never been tied to anything,
right,
in particular. So from a sort of a strategic political point of view, that's a winner for Republicans, and Mitch McConnell is telling his Republicans, and we make him ask and we force Democrats to vote on this question two more times, and guess what? We never have to vote for it. Because when the president asks, the only way we can deny it is with two-thirds majorities. Well, that'll never happen. So we can always vote no. He always has to ask yes. So the politics for us are beautiful. I mean, that's the internal political argument being made for the McConnell proposal.
Right.
But I would just say, my experience, and I've met a lot of these Tea Party-inspired freshmen and a lot of the Republicans like Rand Paul and others in the Senate, like, no, I'm sick to death of that. Marco Rubio is a classic example. That's it. I came to Washington to get rid of all that stuff. Well, good luck trying. And they are trying. And they've significantly altered the contours of this debate. But in the end, I think what you're going to find is something that has political craftiness and less structural reform.
Major, I am out of time. We're talking today to Major Garrett, congressional correspondent of the National Journal. Major, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, too. We'll do it again.
All right. We're coming up.